Since February 2019, that's 2 years ago, the people of Algeria have waged an inspiring and historic revolt. Millions took to the streets, united in their rejection of the ruling system, demanding radical democratic change. They chanted, "They must all go, and the country is ours, and we'll do what we wish." Two slogans that have become emblematic of this new Algerian revolution. The popular movement, or how it is called in the country, Hirak in Arabic, succeeded in overthrowing President Abdelaziz Bouteflika in early April 2019 after 6 weeks of protests. The weekly protests continued every Friday since then, and only in March 2020, with the COVID-19 pandemic forcing a lockdown, did this mass movement see a temporary halt of around 10 months. But the Hirak has come back and it resumed its weekly protests from this February and is regaining its strength and momentum. My name is Hamza Hamouchen. I'm the North Africa Program Coordinator at TNI, and I will be your host today. To talk about all of this and give some analysis about the motivations, objectives, challenges, and the horizons of the uprising in Algeria, our guest Brahim Rouabah agreed to chat to us. Brahim Rouabah is an Algerian activist, co-founder, and former head of UK-Algeria Solidarity Campaign. He is currently a PhD candidate in political science at CUNY in New York and a graduate teaching fellow at Brooklyn College. Welcome, Brahim, and thanks for accepting our invitation.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation, and I'm glad to be here.
Brahim, let's start by giving more background to our listeners. Could you please tell us a bit more about the uprising or the revolution? What is it about exactly, and who are the actors involved? Basically, we would like to hear more about the what, the why, and the who.
So for the past 2 years, you've had a popular movement that cuts across demographic lines, across class lines. Essentially, what the demand is the realization of independence. There is a feeling in Algeria that independence from French colonialism has not been completed, has not been realized, that the first stage of it was if you will, the liberation of the land, a sort of military independence or decolonization. And the second stage of it has more to do with giving substance, if you like, to the word independence. So people, as you mentioned, people have been on the streets week in and week out for the past 2 years. There was a suspension of the marches, weekly marches, for a few months due to COVID. And that was a decision taken by the movement, you know, to protect the marchers, knowing that the state has been involved in a sort of organized abandonment of its people, the dismal state in which the health system is, and the defunding that it has been subjected to over the last 3+ decades. Knowing all of this, the movement decided to suspend the marches for a few months until they get a better view of where this pandemic is heading. But since February 22nd this year, the marches are back, and they are back in force, and they will not stop. They will not stop until the objectives of this revolutionary movement are realized and achieved.
So, Brahim, the uprising has been described by Western mainstream media as the revolution of smiles. Some people were focusing on the youth as an important element of the uprising. Others were seeing it mainly as an opposition to the fifth term of the toppled Bouteflika. So what do you think about all these renderings? Was it just an uprising of the middle classes, or did it involve other social classes in there? Was it youth-led? So what was it about?
That's a complex question. In the sense that, are the youth part of the movement? Absolutely. Are they an active and influential component of the movement? No doubt. But without sort of fetishizing the youth element, this is a popular revolution, and it cuts through, once again, demographic lines. You have young and old, men, women, graduates and people who haven't had the chance to get a college education. It's across the country, so it's not based in one part or one region of the country. So we need to understand it as a people's revolution, and that means that it cuts through all these lines: the working class, the unemployed, middle class sections of society are involved. So it's across the board, and it's against, the revolution is trying to overthrow a military oligarchy that has pauperized in many ways the Algerian people across the board once again. So the only sort of form of justice that it knows is its distribution of injustice equally to Algerians.
That's a nice way of putting it. One of the things, usually when we talk about the uprisings in our region, in the Arab region, especially since what is called the Arab Spring, since 2010 and 2011, we've seen a lot of mainstream narratives dissociating the political from the economic, trying to portray those uprisings are mainly uprisings for democracy, for individual and collective freedoms, and not mentioning, the socioeconomic issues underpinning those uprisings. So in the case of the current Algerian uprisings, do you see it as a purely political uprisings, or do you see some economic elements in there as well?
I think this sort of division between the political and economic is more in some ways is more analytical than empirical. And all economics are political, right? Hmm. Every sort of all political issues in some ways are economic. So looking at it through a political economy lens would bring those two components together and would allow us to to avoid sort of being blindsided. Are there political demands in this revolution? Absolutely. Are there economic ones? Of course. And the two go hand in hand. I'm not entirely sure how I would disassociate the two or disentangle the two, but I think they go together. And we see that in the slogans and in the demands of the movement, the opposition or the resistance to the dominance of a military oligarchy in itself tells us that it's both political and economic. There is a rejection of the supremacy of the military rule over civilian affairs, over political affairs. And there is a rejection of the oligarchic side, which has dispossessed the people and has plundered the country's resources. So it's, they go hand in hand, if you like, and they are baked into the same issue, into the same problem. They are one problem as far as the people are concerned. If you're asking the average person on the street, they're not going to tell you this is purely economic or purely political. I was just earlier, before talking to you, I was looking at some of the live streams out of Algeria. And today, the millions who were on the streets, there was a new chant. They were saying the military oligarchy has been creating all these shortages, manufacturing shortages in essential and staple foods. There's been a shortage in the past week or two of cooking oil, and the shortages in water, in drinking water.
Yeah.
And the people were chanting, you can take off our water and you can double the price of the oil, but we are free and we're not out for our stomachs. In some ways saying that you will not bring us back into the house of obedience through these tactics, through trying to make us hungry. This is not a hunger revolution. This is a revolution for freedom, for dignity, for independence, and for justice, for social justice.
That's very, very powerful, Brahim. And talking about those, the slogans and the chants that you just mentioned, and I think one of the amazing features of the Algerian popular movement or the Algeria uprising is that wealth of powerful slogans and chants. You've been in Algeria in some of the protests. I've been myself, and it's something else being in the midst of the multitudes of the millions of people chanting such powerful slogans, very political, very radical. And I think this is, you could say, characteristics of times of revolution when the creative genius of people in resistance, you know, comes to the fore. And we see the energy, confidence, and creativity and subversion. And we also saw like that evolution of slogans in reaction to various deceptive ploys of the ruling elites. And the ones that I remember from like the first weeks in 2019 is Yitnahawga, they must all go, and the country is ours and we'll do what we wish. And there is another one also, you devoured the country, all you thieves. I mentioned to the plunder of resources and corruptions and so on. I'd like to zoom into two slogans right now that remained potent since the first months of the Hirak and maybe even got more powerful. The first one is a civilian, not a military state. And you mentioned the rejection of the military oligarchy. It's Brahim, like this slogan seems one of the key demands of the Algerian popular movement. But some people may say that Algeria is a republic and holds democratic elections regularly, and they won't understand why people are calling particularly for a civilian state when there is at least a civilian facade. So could you speak to this a little bit?
I think, look, the military nature of the Algerian regime is as old as sort of formal independence. So it's since 1962, with formal independence, there has been sort of a supremacy of military leadership over political affairs in the country. And at the core of the military is the sort of the intelligence apparatus that has, in some ways, dominated political life since then. But in the two or three decades following independence, there was sort of a tacit social contract where it is true that that political and civil liberties were curtailed, but in exchange there was, if you like, a counterpart in terms of provision of public goods, like quality education, quality healthcare, a sovereigntist, and in some ways independent, or to a certain extent independent, foreign policy, especially in the sort of context of the Cold War and so on. But since the 92, with the coup and the ensuing dirty war and war on civilians, the military leadership has lost any claim to be in a nationalist military, because now the enemy has become the people, the Algerian people itself. So the instead of performing its constitutional duties, i.e., safeguarding the territorial integrity of the Algerian state and staying out of political life, it has been knee deep involved or involved knee deep into a political life, and it has repressed and in some ways massacred hundreds of thousands of Algerians in the 90s, and plundered the country's resources and enclosed, dispossessed Algerians of their lands, of their you know, and of their publicly owned companies, and so on and so forth. And in the last 30 years, they have been able to maintain a particular narrative, to divide divide and rule. Their divide and rule tactics have worked. In the 90s, they have managed to render the conflict a horizontal one between different sections of society, telling Algerians that your problem is other Algerians who are more religious, i.e. the Islamists in the 90s, the Fees and so on, and prevented Algerians from seeing the true nature of the conflict, which is a vertical one. It's one between governed and governor, and the haves and the have-nots. Those tricks are no longer, they no longer work with this generation of Algerians. Algerians have realized that for so long, their dispossession and their subjugation in part was due to their inability to see where the real problem resides. Now, with this movement, they've put sort of their finger on the at the heart of the problem, saying that our issue is this military oligarchic junta that not only oppresses and dispossesses us, but is also subordinate to foreign powers. And its interests are interlinked, are intertwined with foreign interests, be them corporate or imperialist sort of state foreign state powers. So so I think this is, that's why one of the central, if not the central, slogans has been, we want a civilian, not a military state. And what that means, that that does not mean that it's they are against sort of the military. No, the people are very clear that their problem is with the military leadership. They chant that the military is ours, because this is sort of a popular army. People are conscripted. And so the rank and file of the military are just as oppressed as everyone every other Algerian. So I don't know if that answers the question or
no, no, it does. It does, Brahim. For me, like what it means is that the Algerians, at least most of the Algerians, are telling the military hierarchy or the military bourgeoisie that you cannot hide before that civilian facade, that you manipulate as you wish. We know that you are ruling, and we want you to at least get out of the political life. We want a civilian state, not a military state, not a military state. And actually, this is linked to the other slogan that you touched on at the start, is the demand for independence. And I think for me, at least, that one goes much, much deeper and is a bit more sophisticated. And we've heard that chant in many iterations, including generals to the dustbin and Algeria will be independent, linking both demands, right? So these calls for independence, sovereignty, and the end of the pillage of the country's wealth are accompanied as well by so many references to anti-colonial war veterans who freed Algeria from French colonial rule in the 50s and early 60s. So to me, it seems that the current movement is making a link between their efforts today and their forefathers' struggle for liberation, which is pretty unique in the region. So is it right, Brahim, to say that decolonization is still an ongoing process? Maybe this is controversial to say in the dominant mainstream narrative that decolonization is a thing of the past, but it seems like the Algerian people are saying otherwise.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, once again, that the independence and post-coloniality is a discourse and a discourse of power in some ways that has worked to, in some ways, not entirely, to in fact hide the ways the continuation of colonial dynamics and colonial relationships between the North and the global South. So, Algerians, once again, are alert and aware of that. They're aware that in most so-called post-colonial states, the sovereignty that came with formal independence is not absolute, that it's relative. And that a lot of these sort of elites, be them military military sort of oligarchies or royal families in some places and so on, they are in many ways linked to the colonial metropoles. Their interests are intertwined with the colonial metropoles. So, and it's a well-known sort of principle in politics or in international relations in today's world, in this sort of nation state system, that there are two ways of getting legitimacy for rulers. Either you get it from the people that you rule, or you get it from outside, you know, either domestically or otherwise you'll have to get it internationally from other powers that maintain you in power to the detriment of your own people. And in many cases, once again, the post-colonial states find themselves in this situation, and Algeria being one of them. Mm-hmm. So this military oligarchy is seen as the extension of the colonial metropole, as they are the agents of neo-colonial domination. That they are in Algeria, they may speak Algerian dialect, they may look like Algerians, and so on, but their interests, their bank accounts, their spiritual homes, their sort of retirement plans are not in Algeria. And not just that, also even in terms of policies, the policies that they implement are to the detriment of the people and to the benefit of foreign corporations and states. So once again, this leadership or this oligarchy is seen as an extension of colonial powers in Algeria. And the latest iteration of that we've seen in the 90s and the 2000s how this military oligarchy has tried to gain international legitimacy and support by opening up the economy for foreign capital, denationalizing the economy, both sort of in the natural resources sectors and the so-called liberalization of the investment code. Now the next stage is the denationalization of the military. Now those foreign powers are coming to this military oligarchy, and they are saying, look, your people are against you. Not only you don't have any legitimacy, but you have millions of Algerians on the streets trying to throw you into the dustbin, as you were, as you mentioned, as the one of the famous slogans has it. So for you, if you want to continue receiving our support, now you have to give us your military so we can recolonize the African continent with it. The French and the Americans, they don't want to keep sending their soldiers to the Sahel, to Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and other places. And they want to do it with the Algerian army if they can.
That's a very, very important point that you are making, Brahim. In a way, you are demystifying what the military oligarchy and its nationalist discourse. Like, they are always playing it as if they are the patriots, the nationalists. They are protecting the national interests. And they are describing so many dissidents and so many people in the popular movement as the foreign hands, as if they are agents of foreign powers. And you are demonstrating that this discourse, their discourse, is just vacuous. And the popular movement is saying it clearly. We want independence. And since day one, I remember that there were a lot of slogans and posters saying we don't want the intervention of any foreign powers, be it France, be it Russia, be it the US, be it Britain, be it Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. We don't want the interferences. So there was this kind of, you know, we could say anti-imperialist politics. We don't want to be the next Libya or the next Syria. So this is important, like, to put in context, as well as the other, I find, main feature is the solidarity with Palestine, which makes, you know, the Algerian uprisings, in my view, radical, at least on those elements.
No, totally.
So, Brahim, let's move on to the challenges and difficulties facing the popular movement in Algeria. As you said earlier, the Hirak suspended its weekly protest for almost a year. And in a way, the pandemic had been a blessing for the military regime, as it did everything it could to bury that movement, but in vain, because it came back. I think it's important for our listeners, Brahim, to hear about the ruling elites and military dictatorship's attempt to exhaust, co-opt, and divide the movement. Basically, how did they respond to the uprising?
You mean during the pandemic or since day one?
Since day one.
Well, I mean, look, it's sort of a rule that every revolution has a counter-revolution that accompanies it. So since day one, there have been sort of counter-revolutionary attempts, and those have taken different forms, and they were played out. They played out on different levels, right? So both material and discursive, but also they were domestic, regional, and international. So one of the ways, in fact, discursively, one of the ways that the counter-revolution took place is, as you mentioned earlier, in those ways of depicting, of representing the revolution by making it, trying to make it only about opposition to Bouteflika's fifth term, and that to limit it. So they want to frame it, right, discursively, that this is only about Bouteflika's fifth term. And since he resigned or he was deposed, then there is nothing to see. Just move along, go back home, and there is nothing to do. That's how it operates on a discursive level. Also, the ways that it is represented in foreign media by making it sort of a movement for democracy, but democracy it is in fact a movement for democracy, but not understood in liberal terms.
Yeah.
Right. This is not about sort of holding elections every 4 years and then having a bundle, you know, a few sort of civil rights and civil and political rights here and there. No, this is a democratic movement, but it's a movement that's given new meaning to what the word democracy is, right? It's both economic and political democracy, not only political democracy. So there is a radical redefinition of what democracy is about and also bringing it back to its original democracy, meaning the rule by the people. For the people,
right?
So that's when you hear the word democracy on the streets in Algeria, that's what people mean, not these sort of fluffy, elections and so on and so forth. Even though they are part of it, but on their own, they are just processes. So they are trying to go beyond the procedural definitions of democracy and focusing on the more substantial elements of democracy. Right. So this is at the discursive level. There have been attempts to divide the people once again, to turn the movement's attention, trying to change the geometry of the conflict. You know, from its vertical lines between governed and governor and haves and have-nots, to turn it between people, to divide the people, to divide and rule, divide and conquer. There was almost like a attempt to divide the Algerians along linguistic and cultural lines, trying to paint the movement as mainly a Berber movement, or not even Berber, but like a particular section of it. I.e. Kabil movement, and trying to say paint this particular region as sort of agents of foreign powers, to try and turn public opinion against this region, but also against the Herak itself, against the popular revolution itself, and to demobilize them. Mm-hmm. That has not worked. People from across Algeria came out chanting slogans such as "Lqbayl khawtna barkawna mil fitna," "Kabils are our brothers, stop this divisionary tactics." So at every turn, in fact, at every turn, all these sort of booby traps that were set by the military oligarchy have been diffused. The movement has shown that the official discourse about what the military leadership is and what it does is exactly the opposite. That the military oligarchy accuses the people of things that it itself does. So it accuses the people of being agents of foreign powers while it is the agent of foreign power. It accuses the people of being a threat to national unity, but they are. Their discourse is one that tries to divide the Algerian people. It accuses the movement of being a threat to the state, but in fact, this military oligarchy that has sold out the Algerian economy has sold out its natural resources, and now it's about to turn the Algerian military into a mercenary force in the hands of foreign powers to reconquer or recolonize the African continent. Is a threat to the state. They've become a threat to the integrity of the Algerian state, and to even to its own geography. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, all these accusations that the oligarchy holds or throws at the movement, when examined closely, we find that they fit more this military oligarchy than the movement.
Brahim, what about the repressive measures that the military oligarchy tried to suppress the movement before and during the pandemic? Because there has been a lot of reports, including in Western mainstream media, regarding the imprisonment of some activists and so on. So can you say a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, I mean, thousands of Algerians have been sort of subjected to these repressive measures, arrests, imprisonments. All these are prisoners of conscience and political prisoners. So arrests, imprisonments, judicial control. They're trying, essentially what they are trying to do is to scare enough people. But it's been, to a certain extent, it was targeted. In the beginning, it was targeted. So there was the case of a journalist or two journalists, Saeed Boudour and Khaled Drarni. Probably the latter had more international attention. But that is sending a message. The problem was not particularly Khaled Drarni, but they are sending a message to the press,
yeah,
to journalists, that if you cover, if you just do your job and cover the movement as he was doing at the time, then this is what's going to happen to you. Then they imprison and you know, arrest, imprison, and beat syndicalists and unionists to send the message to the unions. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they fire a couple of judges, right, to send the message to the judiciary that if you if you release these people, because there were instances where people were found innocent of the accusations, but those judges were either transferred to the south, which is seen as in those circles as a punishment,
yeah,
you know, sending them like 1,000 miles away from their families and so on. So there was this attempt. Initially, it was targeted, you know, journalists, lawyers. There was there was the assassination of Tariq Saddam, who's a lawyer in Bourgeois Rij. There is still a question mark on who killed him. And that sent a message to other lawyers who were involved in this, in the group of lawyers who are sort of doing pro bono work with Hirak activists. So there was this targeted campaign, and then it moved to targeting sort of the unifying or frontline activists in each of the cities, in each Algerian city where the Hirak was strong. And there have been multiple cases of torture. Wow. And only now there was the torture, they tortured. This is that the intelligence headquarters or with the center Centre Antar in Ben Aknoun,
mm-hmm,
Karim Tabu, who's head of a political party, was tortured. There was the case of torture and it's documented, of Brahim Duweji, Brahim Duweji is a unionist. He's a teacher and involved in the teacher union. There was the case of torture against Walid Naqish, who was a student.
Yeah.
And multiple other Sami Darnouni, who's currently being held in prison. So torture and in some ways is systemic.
Mm.
And there has been sort of a blackout on information about that. But in the past few weeks, more and more sort of the testimonies are coming out. And even those who have not made their testimony public, they have said enough. They have said, if we tell you, like there is the case of Hamza Jaoudi, who said, if I tell you what happened to me, I'll disappear again. So there is the threat that that if you say what happened to you in these in the intelligence sort of the offices of the intelligence services, then you'll pay dearly for that.
That's very nasty indeed, and it's ironic that these people have been accused of, you know, undermining national unity and threatening national security, while, as you say, it's the military oligarchy that is selling off the economy, opening the door to the Algerian army to intervene outside with other imperialist forces. So yeah, it is ironic and sad. But then there was the
sorry, Hamza, if I may just cut you there. It's not with imperialist powers. No. Under the command, they are not partners.
Yeah,
they will be their dogs. The Algerian army is not going, if they are planning on sending it to Mali, it's not going to be a partner to the French or to the Americans. Yeah. It's going to be a mercenary force. So if they achieve the goals that these powers try to achieve in these places, then all the glory will be taken by these imperialist powers. But if they fail, then the danger of the Algerian military breaking up and eventually even the country breaking up. So in both cases, it's Algerians and Algeria that will lose. So I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, you're right. Right, 100%. You're right, 100%, Ibrahim. It's like the Algerian regime is enshrining, you could say, reinforcing the subordination to the imperialist world order.
Exactly. And
on top of what you said about, you know, the imprisonment, judicial harassment, and the torture, several media have been censored. There are some independent websites that have been banned, so they are not accessible in Algeria. And there is also a new law to strip people and dissidents or living outside, like the diaspora, of their citizenship. So the regime is trying all the
time. It was a proposed law. It's not a law.
Yeah, it's a proposal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other thing that that I have seen in the last few months and weeks, Ibrahim, is in the regime's attempt to divide the movement, this time is by raising the specter of radical Islamism and the potential terrorist infiltration of the hierarchy. And as you mentioned, there is a dirty history behind this, which is the 1992 military coup that prevented the Islamic Salvation Front from winning the first multi-party elections since independence, and the atrocious war that followed against civilians, killing an estimated 200,000 people. Brahim, can you enlighten us briefly about this? Why is the regime using this card now? Is it working? And what are the dangers looming over the Hirak?
Look, the regime has sold itself to Europe and to the West in general since 2001, the unfortunate events of September 11th, that we have fought, this is how they sold themselves to the West, saying that, look, we have fought this Islamist terrorism before, and we have 10 years of experience in it. And we will be your policemen in the region if you just sort of support us and keep us in power. And they have managed sort of to label anyone who opposes their rule or resists it as a terrorist or terrorist groups.
And this is a tactic. This is a tactic that is now very well known. Anyone who questions the status quo and the powers that be is labeled as a terrorist. Now, what they are trying to do in the 90s, they were, you know, they had a free hand, right? They controlled the media, audiovisual media. They controlled the press, the written press. And there was no internet and, no social networking. There were no other ways to document what was happening. So only the official narrative was put out there. And that was taken at face value in many cases, most of the time. Now they can't do that. What they are trying to do now, after trying to and failing to divide the people along cultural or linguistic lines, now they are using the Islamist secularist divide, and they worked counter-revolutionary forces, international, regional, and domestic, have used that in Tunisia with some success. They have used it successfully in Egypt. Right. In 2013. And that's how you had the coup and the political cover for the coup and Sisi's rule. And they are trying to use it here. So it's the same. It's the same book and it's the same actors. Right. Either the Gulf statelets, they are Zionist master, or they are international backers. That's their the repertoire, if you like, of tactics, of divide and rule tactics. By now, Algerians have figured them out. And what they are trying to do now is to paint the movement as Islamists and potentially as terrorists, right? This is a movement that's been on the streets for 2 years. Not a single glass was broken. The hallmark of the movement is its pacifism and rejection, categorical rejection of any form of violence. Because the movement has realized that the oxygen of a military oligarchy is violence, right? They want that. That's their preferred game. They want the movement to not be peaceful, to have, you know, riots or to have instances of violence so they can justify the repression, harsher repression. So now they are trying, and in the last week or two, they have painted sections of the Hirak, like the Rashad movement. They are trying to paint it as Islamist and potentially terrorist. And this is with the help of Western media, even the AFP, the Agence France-Presse. Has published like two pieces in the past 2 weeks where it describes the Rashad movement as Islamist, even though the movement doesn't claim that. And, you know, they present themselves as nationalist democratic movement. But there is this attempt by the regime and its international backers to demonize the movement or at least parts of the movement to make any coalitions, large coalitions, impossible. And the sort of the streets have responded to that. And one of the new chants that has been going around in the last couple of weeks, especially after these cases of torture, one of the main slogans now is Mukhabarat Irhabiya. The intelligence services, the DRS, is a terrorist organization, and down with the military mafia. Yeah. So they're again, the movement is turning the table, saying that the terrorist is this political police, if you like, not the movement. Or the sections of the movement that you're trying to paint as terrorists.
Yeah, that's actually, that reminds me of another slogan, Brahim, that has been around, I think, for more than a year. The one I would say, there is no Islamist, there is no secularist, there is only a gang that is stealing us in daylight. Like, and that reveals the popular genius and the intelligence of the popular uprising seen through all these deceptive ploys. And hopefully it will maintain its unity and pacifism, as you mentioned. And I think that will bring me, that brings us to our last question, Brahim, is around the horizons and perspectives of the Hirak. So we see at a time when the military regime is ignoring the popular movement and is pushing for its own roadmap and agenda through bogus elections. We saw that they pushed for December 2019 election that has been largely boycotted. And then they pushed for another constitutional referendum in November 2020 that has been largely boycotted as well. And now they are pushing for legislative elections in 2021. So what are the perspectives and what the Hirak should be doing at a time when the regime, you know, is taking the initiative? Do you think, because I know that there are a lot of discussions inside the Hirak as well, and we had those discussions, you and me, in the past, around the need to structure, to set up some structures and collective leadership to force the military into the negotiation table. And to force them to yield on some of the demands of the Hirak?
Look, this sort of these pushing through these fake elections and as you saw in the referendum, which had 8%, a constitutional referendum that they pushed through with 8%
wow.
Participation. So that gives you, that tells you the official
is 23.7.
23.5, I think.
Yeah.
So let's just go, and we know that the official numbers are usually, you can divide them by three at least, right? But let's just take it at face value. 23.5, right?
Yeah.
So officially, they're admitting that over 76% of Algerians were against, they boycotted this constitutional amendment, and still they pushed it through.
Yeah.
So it's in they're tacitly acknowledging. They're tacitly acknowledging that they have no legitimacy. And this is what they call in French, la fuite en avant.
Mm.
So they are just, they know that their days are numbered. And by sort of turning a blind eye or, you know, closing their ears to what Algerians are demanding, that's not going to save them. This movement is going to succeed. And all that they are doing is they are, if you like, they're increasing the tab, the cost of change. That's all they are doing. The change is going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when and how much it's mm-hmm. going to cost. So if there has been a willingness, the willingness of the movement to negotiate, and the window for that is closing, slowly closing, and we may find ourselves with guillotines in public squares for these generals. So it's up to them how they want to exit the scene. They're going to exit it no matter what. How they're going to exit it is up to them. And also, there is a message also to their backers, foreign backers, the types of relations that tomorrow's Algeria is going to have with these sort of forces and powers is going to depend on their policies now, and what their, you know, the support or lack thereof they're given to this military oligarchy. Once again, the movement does not want any form of support from any foreign power. All the movement asks for is for them to stay out of it.
But Ibrahim, does the movement need to endow itself with some structures that can push it forward, because it seems that the struggle is going to be long. It's not going to just be a matter of months. That military dictatorship, you know, is entrenched in its its rule over the political and economic system. So having that kind of horizontality and weekly marches, even if by the millions, seems to not shake the regime in a way that is gonna that is amenable to a radical change, like the change that the Hirak wants, which is a civilian state, not a military state.
I think over the past 2 years, there has been a lot of structure in happening. It's not visible because the most familiar way for us to recognize it is to see associations and organizations and political parties and forming and coming. You know, that's not gonna, you're not gonna see that in a repressive context like Algeria. You're not gonna, you know, they're not going to allow new parties to come into existence unless they are parties of the intelligence services, right? Mm. Or other, you know, that they have their blessing. You're not going to see syndicates and unions forming. So if you're looking for formal expressions of organization and structuring, I think you're looking in the wrong direction. That's not what's going to, you're not going to see it. And that is going to give you an idea that there isn't much organization or structuring happening. But in fact, there is. But the movement also is aware, the collective genius realizes and has learned from history that you do not give an indication of who the leadership is. Because if you assign, even if it's a collective leadership, then there are three options. Either they get assassinated, they get imprisoned, or they get exiled. Yeah. That's the the movement is holding back from putting forward its leadership, right? Mm. And it does not mean that it doesn't exist. Leadership exists, but they are holding back from putting it forward until the right time. And the right time is when they submit, when this oligarchy submits and is ready to hand over the keys, then the movement will send someone to get the keys.
Thanks for clarifying this, Brahim. Anything else you want to add? The last word?
The last word is, maybe it's in two parts. I think the hallmark of the movement has been its peaceful sort of mode of action, and that is absolutely a red line that cannot be infringed upon. So peacefulness, unity of the people, unity that is diversity within unity. When we say unity, then we don't mean unicity. Not every Algerian has to think the same way.
Yeah.
But there can be diversity of views, of ideologies, of political positions and programs. But this is within a unity to create, to get rid of this military oligarchy that has been oppressing Algerians, and to create the conditions for all Algerians to flourish and to be emancipated. So those are unity, peacefulness, and radicality, meaning that there is no middle way with these. We're not going to have a Sudanese outcome in Algeria. You don't share when you find burglars in your house. You don't sit with them on a table and share your belongings with them. You throw them in prison. You get them punished. And that's what's going to happen to this military oligarchy sooner or later. Those are the three lines.
So, and in terms of internationally, the powers that are sort of have been supporting this this military oligarchy, they just need to realize that Algerians have a long memory. And as you said, sort of the references that the movement makes with the decolonization movement and war for liberation heroes, that shows you that that Algerians always remember, never forget their friends, and much less their enemies.
Thanks, Brahim. This has been a truly informative and fascinating conversation. The struggle continues, the struggle for democracy, for decolonization, for anti-imperialism. Hopefully, fingers crossed. And I share your hope as well. And let's see. Hopefully, the Algerian people will win.
They will.
Thank you, Brahim.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Hamza.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.